Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, and we are going to talk about Dr. Martin Luther King this hour of the program with special attention to the dream, the speech delivered at the March on Washington in 1963. Our guest is the author of The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. Drew Hansen is our guest. And Drew became profoundly interested in this speech when he was taking a course in law school at Yale on the civil rights movement and the Constitution. And he talks about how remarkable that speech was. In many ways, he says, Dr. Martin Luther King was a genius, and we'll talk about his genius and talk about what went into that speech. I was not aware of how a good chunk of the speech really was extemporaneous, and how it was received, what the country was like not all that long ago. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Drew as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Just to place this in time, back in 1963, when this speech was delivered, the country was really in the middle of a racial nightmare. In the summer of 63, there were still many segregated school districts. Less than 10% of African Americans in the South's 100 largest counties were registered to vote. In many places, blacks could not serve on juries. In Birmingham, Alabama, the police commissioner, Bull Connor, turned his dogs on peaceful demonstrators. On May 28th of that year, the Jackson, Mississippi home of Medgar Evers, state field secretary for the NAACP, was firebombed, and 2 weeks later, he was assassinated in front of his home. In Danville, Virginia, civil rights workers faced fire hoses. In Americus, Georgia, police beat peaceful protesters. In Winona, Mississippi, police arrested Fannie Lou Hamer because she attended a voter registration workshop. They took her to jail, beat her, and plotted to drown her in the river. Late on the afternoon of August 28th, 1963, the Reverend Martin Luther King was at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and, despite all of this, talked about his dream deeply rooted in the American dream. So we're going to talk about all of this this hour and welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Drew Hansen, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I don't know if you knew, but I was actually born in Merrill, Wisconsin, so it's great to be able to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I didn't know that. Yeah, John Treader was just telling me that, and you're also one of our guests last hour was a Packers fan, and
hey,
you are as well.
Terrific. Well, and I think a lot of my family's still in Wisconsin, so if my cousins Zachary Cullen and Maggie May are listening, I wanted to say hi to them.
Oh, that's nice. And maybe they'll call in and talk to you,
that
too.
That would be great.
That would be great. You talk about, I saw an interview with you last night after the Packer game, of course, but you were talking about the genius of Dr. King, the genius of this speech we'll get to, but tell me more about what you mean by his genius.
Well, he's a unique person, and I'm not saying anything that none of your listeners don't already know, but he, on the one hand, he is a phenomenal Baptist preacher, one of the best of his generation. He is at the same time and someone who is a keen student of social philosophy. I mean, he's someone who can debate Reinhold Niebuhr on Meet the Press and put it in the context of the freedom struggle. Mm. He is at the same time a brilliant tactician, someone who realizes that dramatic confrontations with segregation were going to be one of the ways to awaken the nation to its injustice. And he has a great and deep calling, he felt, from God, that he was willing to follow even at times when it was very unpopular, as in when he spoke out against Vietnam and when he marched against segregation in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And this calling, really, he spoke, I was listening to his speech, the Memphis speech yesterday as well. I love that speech as well. It's just beautifully written, go through the whole course of time. But this had this sense that his life was in God's hands in a way that he knew there were death threats all over the place on his life. He must have known that could have been something that would happen to him in his lifetime, and yet he transcended this life in some ways.
Well, that's right. He lived under truly extraordinary pressure. He got death threats regularly, beginning in the Montgomery bus boycott and continuing up to his death, some of which we later found out were sent by the FBI.
Yeah.
So he was harassed not only by crazy people all around the country, he was harassed by our own government.
Yeah. Who had the idea? You talk about the fact that it had been around since the 1940s to have this massive civil rights demonstration in Washington. Was it King's idea or somebody else's?
No, it wasn't. It was really the brainchild of A. Philip Randolph, who was a labor organizer who had suggested a march on Washington in the Roosevelt administration. And it had always been his dream to have a national march with thousands and thousands of people on issues of civil rights and of economic justice. And so he started trying to organize that again in the 1960s, and King jumped in on that effort and became a part of it.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and you got this information, ironically enough, because it was wiretapped by the FBI, that King, a couple days after Birmingham, they were having a conference call deciding what to do next, and so this idea of this massive civil rights demonstration came up.
That's exactly right. It's one of the odd ironies of this period that because of the FBI's wiretaps, we have a very, very good historical record of exactly what was happening with Dr. King in, among other times, the summer of 1963. And we can hear him planning for something to do that will continue on the momentum that they got because of Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response when people heard there was going to be this kind of demonstration? I just outlined a few of things that were happening in the country. This was a really, you know, we make his life this. We whitewash all the things that happened. These were horrible times in this country. People were dying for the right to vote, and people were getting tear gassed, and they were being killed. It was a horrendous time in American history, and we make light of all of that, I think, or we forget that part of what was going on in America now.
No, I think that's right, and that's one of the real weaknesses of the way the civil rights movement is typically taught in schools in this country, is that it is the violence of segregation is minimized or downplayed. I mean, you can sit through a high school history lesson on the civil rights era and think that segregation is just a matter of not being able to go into a particular side of the restaurant to eat a hamburger.
Right, right.
And what you don't hear and what you should hear is that there were counties in the South where it was like apartheid South Africa or Stalinist Russia. I mean, people literally disappeared in the middle of the night and turned up tortured or were never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
Children were thrown in jail. People were imprisoned in barbed wire outdoor camps with machine guns trained on them. It was really very brutal and very, very violent. And unless we teach that aspect of the movement, we end up minimizing what happened and minimizing the courage of the people who stood up against it.
And why do we refrain from teaching that aspect of the movement, do you think?
I think people are hesitant to admit or confront just how brutal and how sinful the system of segregation was. I mean, there's a tendency to treat it as a well-intentioned but misinformed decision that was made to maintain local cultural values. And I think that really, it really understates just how bad things were. And the only way really to take account of the movement is to realize exactly how violent it was to be, you know, a black American who wanted to vote in Sunflower County, Mississippi in 1962.
Yeah. So it's interesting that considering all of this, all of the horror, that Dr. King gives this "I have a dream" speech, right? He has a dream still, despite all this violence, despite all this phenomenal inequality, he's got this very deep-seated hope.
Well, that's right, and that's one of the real strengths of the speech and the key to its enduring success, that at a time when nothing could have been further from reality than that black children and white children would hold hands together as sisters and brothers, King is able to describe those visions in a way that makes people believe them, just at least for the 16 minutes while he's speaking. And that's really what I call in the book the prophetic gift that he has, that he's able to, like the prophet Isaiah, look forward and describe this world that might one day come to pass.
Yeah. And I did not realize that a good chunk of this, probably the part of the speech that we most remember, Drew, was done somewhat spontaneously. I mean, he had the ideas in previous speeches, but he did away with his text.
Yes, that's right. He did. He had worked on a number of drafts of his speech and eventually finished it up and brought it to the podium with him. But the speech that he brought to the podium didn't include the phrase, "I have a dream." And so the I Have a Dream section was something that he had used before in many other contexts, but eventually decided to just launch into as he was speaking.
And was it because Mahalia Jackson urged him to? Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream.
You know, we don't really know. I mean, I think it's very possible that he heard her. He doesn't, the one time he talks about why he used the I Have a Dream refrain, he doesn't remember it. He doesn't say anything about Miss Jackson. But it's, you know, he might have just forgotten, and he probably did hear it. It would be very much like what would happen in a call-and-response situation where Miss Jackson is a gospel singer and Dr. Kane is a Black Baptist preacher, and that sort of interaction between the preacher and, for lack of a better word, the choir and feeding off one another would be very expected in a way in that context.
Right. And the television coverage, there was television coverage of this, right? Regular programming was interrupted, which I find interesting.
That's right. It ended up being a much bigger media event than anyone could have expected. Actually, while they were making the plans for the speeches that day, Kane ended up on the last spot of the day, partly because no one wanted to speak after him, but partly because a lot of the other speakers thought, well, gosh, by that time, all the cameras will have left to process their film for the evening news, and so if we actually want to get on the news clips, we better speak earlier in the day.
Isn't that something? And I'm wondering what happened on the level of decision-making at the networks, why they decided to run this. Was it because they wanted everybody to hear the dream? Was it because they perhaps were expecting a lot of trouble? Because people were expecting trouble. White politicians, a lot of them... some of them talked about these people are going to come and overthrow the American government when they march on Washington, right?
Well, I think the real reason is it was just such a massive demonstration. I mean, in this era of, you know, frequent marches on Washington for every imaginable cause, it is easy to forget just how significant it was in 1963 to have 250,000 people show up and in a peaceful and nonviolent way demand action on civil rights and on economic opportunity.
Yeah. How hard did he work on this speech?
He worked very hard. It was actually very unusual for him. He usually did not do anything more than jot down a few words on the back of a church bulletin before he would get up to speak. But this he started working on a couple weeks before the march. He got his aides together to talk about ideas. He solicited drafts from some of his aides. He got some help the night before from Wyatt T. Walker, a great and famous Black preacher now in New York, and he put them all together into the draft that he wanted to give. So the amount of careful preparation and planning was very unusual for him. And, of course, what happens at the march? He throws out a lot of his careful preparation and planning and does what he always do, which is preach a sermon.
Yeah. And why did that happen, do you think? Did you think it was a matter of somebody else sort of taking over for him at that point? It was divine intervention, in a sense?
I think he realized that the speech that he had intended to conclude with was not going to be good enough. He had the written conclusion in his speech was pretty dull. And if you look at the original speech, which I excerpt in my book, you can tell that it's nothing like the I Have a Dream refrain. I think he just realized that with the crowd as fired up and motivated and engaged as it was not going to be right to go into this very pedestrian conclusion. He needed to do something that was more soaring and more appropriate to the urgency and emotion of the moment.
You talk about the Bible, the Gettysburg Address, and the Declaration of Independence being very important to Dr. King, and you can see elements of that, particularly in the beginning of the speech, right? I mean, he's speaking in front of the Lincoln Memorial, but this 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation, and then he talks about 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. Don't you hear shades of Abraham Lincoln there?
Oh, absolutely, and that's very intentional. Kane, of course, knew he would be standing under the great statue of Lincoln at the memorial, and a few days before the march, he told one of his speechwriters that he wanted to do sort of a Gettysburg Address. So the resonances of Lincoln's precedent were very much on Kane's mind.
Yeah. And what do you think about his first thoughts here? I'm happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Do you think that it was? Do you think it still is?
I think it's hard to identify anything else that had the magnitude at the right historic moment that the 1963 march did. I mean, there were earlier marches on Washington, of course, there have been many since, but it's a unique time in the civil rights movement, the summer of 1963, right after the movement has really captured the public attention, and right before the movement is about to win its greatest legislative victory in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so a demonstration of that size coming at that time, I still think is fairly unique in American history.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour, as we celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Drew Hansen, who's the author of The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. And that is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we do want to tell you that Larry had a change of guests. So after 11 this morning, conserving Wisconsin's cultural and natural resources will be the topic. Let's go to phone calls now for Drew Hansen. Our number is 800-486-8655. His book is The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. William from Colfax is our first caller. Hi, William.
Hi. I guess what I wanted to say was that Martin Luther King, he was a great man, and whenever they commemorate him these days, it seems like they just talk about a man of peace and the civil rights movement. But toward the end of his life, he was when he was assassinated, he was there in support of a labor strike, and he was starting to speak out against the injustice of the industrial military complex and the labor rights and all sorts of things that went beyond just the civil rights, and those sort of things generally get ignored, and they've kind of he was radical, maybe the most hated man in America, but even the government was trying to destroy him, and by turning him into just this sort of nice man of peace, I think it sort of takes the edge off his message, which I think is, in some ways is the intention of that movement.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, yeah. He was radical in many of his thoughts, wasn't he, Drew?
Well, and I think it's worth remembering that in 1963 he was as radical as he was in 1967. It's just that from a vantage point of 40 years later, when segregation in a legal sense is gone, it's easy for us to forget just how challenging and just how radical that contest against segregation was. But you're absolutely right, of course. I mean, at the end of his life, the two issues that preoccupied him were economic justice and labor issues and the war in Vietnam. And he was very publicly outspoken on both of these, and it cost him a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. You, in what I was watching last night, made reference to a speech that he gave. It may have been on Christmas Eve in the end of 1967, in which he talked about the industries of Appalachia.
That's right. It's a funny thing. It's another version of the I Have a Dream speech, and instead of the one we know about in 63, it's the one he gave on Christmas Eve in 1967, just before his death, where he returns to the I Have a Dream image, but instead of talking about his dreams that segregation in the South will be gone, he focuses very intently on poverty in the North. He says, I have a dream that one day the idle industries of Appalachia will be revitalized and the empty bellies of Mississippi will be filled. And you clearly see in that the shift in his focus, that he is moving on to the economic opportunity issues that he still was looking forward to think that God would deliver America from, just as God had delivered America from segregation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Jim is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. King taught us that power is not relinquished without a demand, but the interesting thing is that since the assassination of Dr. King, the media has learned that you have to restrain the demand. Michael Parenti, political scientist, points out that supply creates demand. So if you thwart the supply, you thwart the demand. And you have to look at that in the context of how the contemporary media handles things in terms of recent history. The myth, and one of the things they do is they construct myths, one of the myths being that the media is liberal. If the media was liberal, they wouldn't thwart the supply of candidates like Kucinich and Ron Paul, or nor would they fail to report that Paul finished second in Nevada. And they wouldn't, and this weekend they would have discussed the moral issue, which came out in the Canadian press about the fact that the Canadian ambassador, or government put in a manual that says that the United States tortures, which, of course, is a contradiction of the President of the United States' statement that our government does not torture. The media would cover these things. So the media, saying that the media is liberal is a lie, and saying that that we don't torture is a lie. And the question that we have to ask people is, well, what else are they lying to us about? And that's what Dr. King would have done.
Drew.
Yeah, I think the media coverage on Dr. King varied widely. And one thing that we forget in a post-legal segregation era is that there was a wide variety of really, you know, first-rate black newspapers. So there was a greater diversity of both editorial opinion and news coverage on something like the civil rights movement than there is even today with the advent of the internet and blogs, because you did have professional top-rate journalists covering these issues from a variety of different perspectives before a variety of different audiences. So I think it's an interesting commentary on maybe the difference between the media now and the media then, but even having said that, there's no question that kind of pundit opinion about Dr. King and the op-ed class had very distinctly turned against him by the end of his career, thinking that his opposition to the war in Vietnam and his marches in Chicago were costing him support and not doing any good, and he had become simultaneously too radical and an afterthought. Too radical because those issues were so controversial, mm-hmm. and an afterthought because there was the rise of the more violent black power movement that just thought the southern nonviolent phase of the movement, led largely by preachers, was something whose time has passed.
Mm-hmm. When he talks in the dream, in his dream speech, and says, even though we face difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. What does that mean? Is it deeply rooted in the American dream?
It very much is. I mean, the entire speech harkens back to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and, as you know, we mentioned earlier, the Gettysburg Address. So the whole message of the speech, and a lot of the message of the civil rights movement, was that civil rights and equality for black Americans is simply a matter of being faithful to what America promised, that if we take seriously the guarantees of freedom and equality from all that are written in our founding documents, we can't do anything other than guarantee full justice and full equality for people of all races. And that was really the rhetorical strategy of Dr. King in any number of his speeches. And it wasn't just Dr. King. It's something that President Kennedy says in his June 1963 speech on civil rights, where he says, this is a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. It's something that is very prominent in the congressional debates over civil rights. So this appropriation of the founding documents of America and deploying them in the context of the civil rights struggle was, I think, a real secret to the oratorical success of the movement.
Mm-hmm. And Kennedy was watching King on television. His response was, that guy is really good.
Yeah. Well, of course, Kennedy is a gifted orator, and he appreciates a good line. And he was certainly awfully impressed with what he'd seen at the memorial. And there was a reception afterwards at the White House for the leaders of the march. And Kennedy greeted King and gave him a big grin and said, I have a dream. Hmm. I mean, it's a compliment from one rhetorician to another. But he also realized it is, as Kennedy himself had put it, a significant moral issue. And there is, of course, a religious and spiritual dimension to Dr. King's speech, where he invokes the Bible, he invokes the prophet Isaiah. And I think that it's hard to imagine that the moral power of that sort of appeal wasn't very moving to the president as well.
Was the administration worried about this demonstration before it took place?
They were absolutely petrified.
Really?
They were very concerned about two things. One, that it would turn into a riot because of just how confrontational and violent things had gotten in the South with the Birmingham campaign. And two, they were worried that it would actually draw attention away from the pending civil rights bill. I mean, from the president's perspective, the most important thing to do in 63 was to get the civil rights bill that he had just sent to Congress passed. And he was worried that if there was a demonstration, people in Congress would get their backs up and say, well, I'm not going to bow before people marching on Washington. That's not part of what I do. I want to do this on the merits. Of course, not realizing that the whole point of people being able to come to the nation's capitals to petition the government for redress of grievances.
Mm-hmm.
So those two issues made the Kennedy administration, you know, very, very cautious about the march, and it's why one of the things that they did, they spent a lot of time, particularly from the Justice Department, in making sure that the demonstration would be peaceful and that everything would go off all right that day.
Hmm. So it actually took Kennedy, King, and Johnson to get this all passed, right?
to put it in today's controversial terms.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for your call. We go to Rich from Sullivan next. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Wow, how things have changed within my lifetime. And I'm calling because these days there's a lot of talk about change and experience, and I'm far from a Martin Luther King scholar. An admirer, but not a scholar. And I wanted your guest's comments, if he's willing to make them, on this issue of experience, because what I know about Martin Luther King is that, in some ways, he wasn't prepared for this role. I mean, I know he was a minister, and I know he was eloquent, but I don't think he really, from his beginnings, saw himself as leading this kind of a social movement. It sort of fell to him, and he
right.
rose to the occasion. The reason I bring that up is Nicholas de Kristoff yesterday in the New York Times wrote about Abraham Lincoln, another legislator from Illinois, who on the surface would seem ill-prepared to become the leader of a nation during one of the most tumultuous times in that nation's history. And, Kathleen, I'm sorry, but I'll end by saying that's why I'm supporting Barack Obama.
Oh, I didn't know that was coming, Rich. I couldn't
sorry,
see that. Thanks very much for your call. Drew?
Well, sure. And I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that I'm supporting Barack Obama, too, and trying to do what little I can to help him get elected. But that let that color or not color my comments as they may. But the caller does make the excellent point that Martin Luther King did not set out to be a leader of a mass social movement. I mean, remember, he spent most of his late teens and his early 20s in school. He was at Morehouse, then he was taking his seminary degree at Crozier Theological Seminary, and he got his PhD at Boston University. And at none of these places was he known as an activist or a leader of campus protest. I mean, if anything, he was known as a serious student and a bit of a man about town. And he was, you know, he was someone who really enjoyed being with his friends and being able to, you know, being able to hang out with them and talk philosophy with them. That's really what he did. But when he comes back to Montgomery and he comes back to the South, he finds himself in the middle of a protest that the women of Montgomery had planned against bus segregation. And the women of Montgomery start this protest without any of the men, without any of the preachers, and all of a sudden the Black preachers in Montgomery meet, and they need someone to be the public face of the movement. And it falls to King, not because he's thought to be more gifted, but because he's the youngest, and there's some thought that as the new guy in town, if it backfires, it'll redound on King and not on some of the more prominent preachers.
Oh, my.
And I think his career is a demonstration of the value of judgment over experience. I mean, he learned as he went, very literally, and he showed over and over again that a capacity to make wise and sound decisions under pressure doesn't necessarily require great years and doesn't necessarily require great time and expertise. It's more, I think, a feature of who you are as a person and how you've been constituted.
So, Drew, how old was he when he gave the speech?
He was, gosh, he was in his early 30s.
Was
33.
Isn't that amazing?
Truly.
33 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, and we forget, you know, this means that in the heyday of the civil rights movement, the time from Montgomery to Selma, King is in his late 20s and his early 30s.
Yeah.
That is the time when the Southern movement wins its greatest victories and when King is maintaining extraordinary confidence and calm under amazing pressure.
And he only would have been 79 years old.
Well, that's right. It's easy to forget that he would have been a comparatively young man. I mean, we have justices of the Supreme Court that are older than he is, and so he would still obviously be very vigorous and very active had his life not been cut short.
Yeah. Our phone number, we have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation now, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Rich, thanks very much for your call. And Drew's book is The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. Our email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Tell me how you were drawn to this particular speech, Drew, and dissected it and looked at what was happening historically at that time. Why this speech?
Well, it's really the speech that stands out the most to those of us who were born after the 1960s. I mean, it's the speech that without question gets the most public attention in teaching of the Civil Rights Movement and in commemoration of the Civil Rights Movement. And I guess I just got sort of curious as to how it came about that this was the speech that came to represent the entire Civil Rights Movement. Why this as opposed to the other speeches Dr. King gave? For that matter, why a speech at all? I mean, why isn't the most prominent image of the Civil Rights Movement the empty buses in Montgomery or, you know, the fire hoses in Birmingham or the meetings in Selma? And I guess the closer I looked at the speech, the more amazing I thought it was. And so I wanted to be able to do justice to it and try to explain why this speech has been so captivating to us for over 40 years.
Do you think it's his best?
I certainly think it is. I mean, I'm obviously a biased observer. You can make cases for his speech in 1965 at the conclusion of the Selma to Montgomery March. You can make a good case for his Riverside Church speech against Vietnam in the spring of 1967. And, of course, for sheer haunting power, it is hard to beat the speech he gave the night before his death in Memphis, where, you know, he famously said, "I've been to the mountaintop and looked over and seen the promised land, and I may not get there with you." But I think the reason, you know, the reason we remember the I Have a Dream speech in particular is that it is a relatively rare speech, not just in the Civil Rights Movement, but in King's career, where he describes this vision of what America could one day be like if it were a truly free and equal nation. And that's something that, you know, no one in Congress, none of the politicians had been able to do, to look forward in that prophetic way. And it was really his unique contribution to the oratory of the movement.
Let's go to Bobby from Milwaukee next. Hello, Bobby.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. My question is that I understand that Martin Luther King was a kind of a follower or a reader of Gandhi's works in India. And my question was, how do you find or do you find any similarities between how Gandhi handled the British experience and how and what Martin Luther had to deal with the American experience, and if there were any differences culturally between the British and the Americans, and, you know, with the civil and social aspects?
Well, it's a great question. It's one that I wish I knew a lot more about than I do. I mean, I can certainly say, as you know, that King was very aware of the Gandhian precursors to the nonviolent movement in the South. And in conversation with Bayard Rustin, who would later be the organizer of the March on Washington, with Harris Wofford, later Senator Harris Wofford, as you know, he developed the theory that nonviolence was the only adequate response to segregation. And, of course, a lot of what was inspiring him was Gandhi's example. I mean, he would quote a line from Gandhi repeatedly, that rivers of blood may flow before justice is won, but let it be our blood. And this Gandhian nonviolent message, of course, dovetailed very nicely with Dr. King's upbringing in the Black Baptist tradition and Orthodox Christian theology, where the teaching of the suffering of the innocent is as being redemptive is, of course, a very, very prominent theme in Christian theology. And it was something that King actually echoes at the March on Washington when he says, let them see that unearned suffering is redemptive. So King's real contribution, I mean, if you think of nonviolent theory and practice as a continuum that begins with Gandhi and kind of goes through the Civil Rights Movement, I think King's contribution was the addition of the Black Christian perspective to nonviolent practice.
And thank you so much for the call. Unless you had something else, Bobby.
Nope, that was it. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, thank you. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, we speak with Drew Hansen. who is the author of The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Speech That Inspired a Nation, published by HarperCollins. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655, our number, and Abby from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Abby.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the state of things today. I remember on the last anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education last May, there was a lot of information out about how schools have started to resegregate and a lot of schools have stopped busing programs. And I wonder if Drew thinks that we need another sort of Martin Luther King figure, another sort of civil rights movement to remind us of what we're losing, because I feel like a lot of people, especially of my generation, and I'm in my early 20s, don't really know how important it is to have integration and desegregation, and I worry that we're losing a lot of that and a lot of that perspective. And so I was wondering what the guest had to say about that.
Well, it's a great point, and the whole issue of school segregation waxes and wanes in public consciousness, and if you look at the numbers, it is clear that schools are very segregated and in most cases becoming more segregated. And it's, of course, partly, if not largely, a function of the fact that housing patterns are very segregated and schools are generally local. So these are long-term inertial patterns. I mean, it takes a long time to integrate neighborhoods residentially and as the first step to integrating schools. But I think what you put your finger on is the how much is lost when we don't think about an integrated education as a good and worthy thing. I mean, you look at if your kids or your friends have been to an actually diverse school where you get an opportunity to interact with people from different cultures and backgrounds, I mean, not just racially, but on every other axis as well. I mean, people who come from different areas of the country, different life experiences, people from different social classes. I think anyone agrees that it's just a richer and better educational environment because you learn more. It's something that is very, very prominent, of course, at the university level and at the law school level as a theme in admissions criteria and as a theme in ways to maximize the educational experience. But it's something that I don't think we talk nearly as much about at the elementary, junior high, high school level, and I think it's a real loss.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Abby. Dave from Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I think that the signature line in King's speech, you know, not looking at a person's color but at the content of their character, is something that we embrace today. But I think there's also a danger because even the fact that we have the national holiday and we repeat this every year, there's a bit maybe of self-congratulatoriness about look how far we've come, and other callers have mentioned that. But the real litmus test, I think, is the fact that our attitudes in many ways haven't changed that much. And when you take a look at the racism and in the anti-immigrant issue, you know, you don't see King's line being applied to that. What's the content of the character of these Mexican immigrants? Are we willing to pay for their education? Are we willing to lift them up and apply decent standards of labor and benefits? And are they being treated fairly when they're in a job and they have no rights and they can just be kicked across the border if they cause trouble? Those to me are the kind of litmus tests of have we really learned the lesson that was being taught us in that speech and in those times. And in many ways, I think we're still flunking that test. And I think that the crossover between the African-American community holding him up as a hero is still, in a way, represents the limitations and the racism that still exists, because those words should be reaching out to the economically disadvantaged and, you know, people of other national origins that come in immigration. And if we've really embraced those values, we wouldn't still be having these deep tensions and divides between the economically entitled and those who are not. That's my comment.
Well, I think it's a great point. There's a tendency at this time of year to be very self-congratulatory about just how different the country is from the way it was 40 years ago. And I think, you know, it's not wrong to be that way. I mean, it's not wrong to look back and say, look, it is, we have come a long ways. I mean, we have made a lot of progress, and it's really, I mean, the right way to use this holiday is to be thankful for that. I mean, to be thankful for the fact that people, in, you know, literally laid down their lives so that we could live in a different country today than the one that they grew up in. Having said that, I mean, the other way to use the holiday is exactly as you suggest, is to reflect on the unfinished business of the Civil Rights Movement. And we've talked a little bit about Dr. King's marches in Chicago and his economic justice crusades at the end of his life, and you bring up the very good point that the civil rights agenda, even in the 60s, embraced a variety of people from a variety of different ethnicities. I mean, Dr. King's, well, at the time of his death, Dr. King was planning a massive multiracial poor people's campaign, a march on Washington like the 1963 march, but focused on economic opportunity for people of all races. Mm-hmm. And he was very intentional about making it include the Native American community, the Latino community, communities of color in the North, white communities that have been disadvantaged in the North. And that was very much part of his vision, and that's part of what was cut short when he was assassinated in the spring of 1967.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call, Dave. Holly is next from Madison. Hi, Holly.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. I was sitting here, I was listening to your program, and I said to myself, he would be very proud to hear y'all speak about him today like y'all are. I'm really enjoying the program.
Thanks, Holly.
Well, hey, thanks a lot. That's great to hear you say that. I hope that's right.
Yeah, well, I was here when all that was going on.
All right, huh?
Right there in Montgomery, Alabama, from the march from Selma to Montgomery.
You were on that march, Holly?
Yes, I was.
Hmm.
That's a long time ago.
It is a long time ago.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. Go ahead, Drew.
I was just going to sit back and watch and listen to your program, but I'm very thankful y'all had the courage to put it on the show today. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. I think it took more courage to go on that march than to do a program on this, Drew. But
yeah, no doubt about
that.
Thank you so much thanks for saying that. Boy, it makes us feel great.
Yeah, thank you very much for your call. Mark from Elk Mound, hello.
I think I might be one of the few callers who's ever actually worked with a black man at a union job in the heavy industry, like in the steel industry. And I would comment that a lot of them were some of the most patriotic men I'd ever met, but they also had a real suspicion of anyone who wanted to come into the black community and tell them that they were victims. And they kind of predicted, I think with an almost biblical accuracy, the effect of years and years of teaching blacks that maybe they were the only ones in the United States that had a tough life.
I'm not sure where you're going with that, but you want to pick up on any of that, Drew?
Well, I think there is a, you know, there's a difficult and complicated line to walk, and it is what Dr. King was so brilliant about doing is pointing out that it was the system of segregation is a burden on black people, but it's also a sin that white people commit. So that it is, the spiritual pain of segregation is something that is felt by white people who have to bear the legacy of hate in a different way than it's felt by black people on whose back it falls on a day-to-day basis. And I think one thing that is a real key to Dr. King's appeal is that it was always a universalist vision. I mean, it was a vision very much of the salvation of the entire nation, not targeted necessarily to one particular group.
You call this text, you refer to it as a sacred text. Why do you use that description?
Because it's one of the only speeches, other than the Gettysburg Address, probably, that people will reflect on a par with the Constitution or with the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it has become one of the documents that we look at when we try to answer the question, what is America like? What do we want our nation to be? There's a very small, select group of texts that we look at to answer that question. And one thing that I Have a Dream does is it's really the only modern answer to that question, even though it is directed, obviously, at the particular historical context of 1963. It is in such overarching tones that are so ringing and so resonant here today. And that's why we teach it to the extent that we do in middle schools and in high schools. speech as well as they know the Declaration of Independence. Yeah. And I think that's exactly right.
Susan is next. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I was just kind of thinking about, I think about Martin Luther King Day every year. And one of the things that I wonder about, and it's not to detract from Dr. King, but is Dr. King's time on earth, his message, one that the general public can accept? Is it just more palatable than someone like, say, a Malcolm X who called the white man the devil? Do we use Dr. King in a way maybe to kind of pacify our own consciousness as a nation because it's easier than looking at other leaders that were more overtly accusing our government and our people of harming blacks and other so-called minorities? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's to the extent we do that, and I do think we do, I think it's the fault of media portrayals of Dr. King rather than the fault of Dr. King. I mean, when we touched on this earlier in the program, Dr. King was tremendously radical all throughout his life. I mean, the challenges to segregation at a time when no one thought the system would fall, the challenges to segregation in the North, and, I mean, King actually said that he'd never seen mobs as hostile or as hate-filled, even in Mississippi and Alabama, as the mobs that met him on fair housing marches in Chicago. This was a tremendously controversial issue. And the way he would talk about white America and the American government's failures was perhaps in less colorful language than Malcolm X, but the substance of the message was the same. He said straight out at the end of his life that people talk about the white backlash now in the late 60s as if America decided to give civil rights, but black people are going too far. But the truth is, America has been backlashing on civil rights for centuries now. And the majority of people in this country are not willing to give things up that will cost them something. Mm. They're willing to give up segregation in the South because it doesn't cost billions of dollars to fix. But when you start talking about housing, when you start talking about jobs, when you start talking about fixing schools, you're talking about something that will cost the nation something, and the nation's not ready for that. Mm. That's almost verbatim from a speech at the end of his life. So Dr. King was, throughout his career, very, very challenging and very, very radical, and that's something that we forget at our peril when we turn him into a nonviolent, pacifist, imperial dreamer.
You know, and you think about those people who have so much in this country, Drew, and you have to ask, what's it to them to give up some of what they have, right? You know, why do you want to hold on to having so much you wouldn't really know what to do with all of it?
Well, and I think it's a difficult line that Dr. King always had to mediate, because the things that he thought were appropriate remedies for segregation are things that in some ways are common sense. I mean, just simply saying that, as President Johnson eventually did, you can't take someone who had been hobbled by segregation for decades and put him at the starting line and say, go. That's not a fair race.
Right, right.
But at the same time, you know, you don't want to be in a position where you're asking for fundamental restructurings of American society in a way that simply aren't going to happen. And towards the end of his life, I think he was trying to figure out exactly where on those two poles he was going to end up. And that process was cut short at a time when he was reflecting about what the appropriate remedies would be and what the appropriate next steps would be. And if he had had that opportunity to reflect on that and design campaigns around that, then we might be living in a very different country. Mm,
yeah, we might. An email, you've touched on this, but let's explore it just a little bit further. How much was the 1963 March on Washington and Dr. King influenced by Gandhi's advocacy of nonviolence and the Free India campaign?
Well, there was definitely an international dimension to the movement in the 60s. People were very much aware of the many freedom movements that were taking place and had taken place recently. There was a real palpable international sense of stirring. And the movement both fed on that and fed to it because, of course, news of the civil rights movement was carried around the world. It was actually, it was one of the reasons that we got civil rights legislation when we did. There were a lot of people in Congress who were seeing the fact that the Soviet newspapers would take footage of burning buses on the Freedom Rides and bombings in Birmingham and plaster them all over the front page and win propaganda victories against the United States. And people in Congress thought, well, we can't have that happen. I mean, that's not, even if it's not worth doing just because you should do it, it's certainly worth doing because we don't want to give the communists something they can use against us. So that whole international dimension of the movement was something that was prominent very much in certainly in Dr. King's mind as well as in the minds of the politicians who supported civil rights.
And another email, I'm somewhat disappointed that so many times when Dr. King is discussed, he's recognized as a great African-American leader. He was a great American leader. I'm struck that one of the very things he was hoping to devalue, that being race, is being perpetuated in part by our media when he is mentioned for the accomplishments he had. In the same way, I feel our media is devaluing Barack Obama by constantly referring to him as they often do. If we are to get past the idea of race, we have to have our media get past it first.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, he is, without doubt, an American hero. That's why today is a federal holiday. And he is someone, obviously, who's admired by people of all races. I mean, I'm a white person for the North, and I was able to go in and do this piece of scholarship. And let me tell you, the people from the Civil Rights Movement, the veterans who talked to me, never gave me 1 minute of an indication that they were that they had any hesitation of someone who was not from that cultural
mm-hmm.
background telling part of the story.
Yeah,
but
and
I
that
think we should remember, like
5 seconds.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
Dr. King's blackness is as important to him as his Christianity, and it's a part mm-hmm. of who he is. And there's no sense in pretending mm-hmm. that it's anything different, and we should
yeah.
recognize that and make that part.
Thank
of
you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Drew, so much for being with us and for the book. Drew Hansen, the book is The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the program and John Treader for on-air production on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.